You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Elegant design. For Jimmy Choo's creative director, Sandra Choi, personal style may start with her shoes, but it certainly doesn't end with them. Go-to shoe, Jimmy Choo Pasha Flat. They symbolize holiday and time out. Statement jewelry, a repoussé ear cuff in gold with diamonds. Beloved purchase, my Celine Moody Blue Shearling knee-length coat. Ideal spring outfit, Calvin Klein white denim volume jeans with frayed hems. I like my denim to be oversized when it's casual and slick when it's with heels. I have a great beige silk oversized blouse from Marcus Almeida that I often wear in spring. Most treasured, a vintage Chanel dress picked up in Milan. Party kicks, vintage Jimmy Choo crystal-encrusted platform dancing shoes, as well as my crystal diamond sneakers for something a little unexpected and fun. Airport outfit, an oversized Bassarange t-shirt. For shorter flights, my cashmere track pants. To sleep, button-down shirts with trousers. Watch, the vintage Rolex that my husband bought me. Must-have skincare product, Aurelia Probiotic Skincare Night Oil. Daily makeup, Chantecaille Radiance Gel Bronzer. Shampoo, Oribe Gold Lust Repair and Restore. Perfume, scents with notes of jasmine and wood. Workout, none. Most recent home addition, my driftwood bench from Dalesford in Gloucestershire, England. Relaxation room, always the kitchen. Bedclothes, I'm reeling into linen at the moment. Watching Netflix's Chef's Table. Listening to David Bowie. On the table, eucalyptus. Home scent, vine tomato by Dalesford. Calendar, iPhone. Sketching pencil, Staedtler Mars Micro 775. Four-legged friends, three goldfish, no legs. A beloved gift, my Land Rover. Supplements, I swear by echinacea. Favorite stationery, Smithson correspondence cards. Luggage, Muji. Beloved artwork, a piece of art by the Korean artist Lee Bae. Always on hand, Aesop Resurrection Aromatic Balm. Morning beverage, homemade juice with turmeric, ginger, kale, celery, lemon, orange, and apple. Post-work drink, Hendrick's Gin with cucumber.
Thank you.
bullet points. A signature lipstick wears like a well-cut uniform, standard issue with flair. This spring, why not expand the ranks? By Laura Regensdorf. Before Wayne Thibault began painting pie slices and lollipops in his now iconic pop pastels, he sharpened his pen in the post-war years as a commercial illustrator. We often had lipstick ads to make, and you had to draw them quickly, with a kind of advertising Esperanto visual language, the 98-year-old says brightly, speaking by phone from Sacramento after a morning round of tennis. For an artist drawn to commonplace objects, lipstick, like gumball machines, another Thibault Rumuse, had a candy-colored charm. But it also brimmed with unlimited potential, he explains. Uncapped, with the pigment twisted up, the tubes resemble cathedral towers. Arranged in single file, as in Lipstick Row, 1964. They become soldiers in formation. But in Thibault's vivid lineup, there's no regimented uniformity, as was the case in 1943, when Elizabeth Arden's custom-blended shade Montezuma Red became the mandated accessory for the Marine Corps Women's Reserve. Instead, his painterly landscape, with wonderful soft color globs of fire engine reds, violets, mauves, suggest plenty of tools for transformation. That sums up the season's lipstick proposition. Forgo fidelity to a well-worn favorite in favor of an adventurous arsenal. Rodarte's spring show proved that a rose-red lip is perennially in bloom. Bright fuchsia at Chanel beamed 80s-era decadence into the present. Meanwhile, Maryam Nasirzadeh, behind the self-titled label and New York boutique, sent shades of matte, lavender, crimson, and raspberry down the runway. The lipstick color brings out a vibration in the clothing, the designer says, musing on the reverb of her own offbeat signature, Max Snob, a purplish pink straight out of Thibault's palette. Zadeh is daydreaming about her ideal warm weather shades, including an opaque pale coral. She likes Illamasqua's Obey and a mocha brown nude. See Charlotte Tilbury's new capsule, inspired by 90s supermodels. Why should an everyday lipstick go unnoticed? The main thing, Thibault reminds us, is to make some drama, even though you're working with a very ordinary subject matter. Photograph by Sharon Corr. Artist Sharon Corr, known for her photographs that meticulously replicate classic paintings, pays tribute here to Wayne Thibault's 1964 lipstick row. The two silver bullets are by Estée Lauder for an era-specific aesthetic. Corr also filled vintage tubes with new pigments by Kevin Aucoin, Rimmel, London, Urban Decay, Chanel, Yves Saint Laurent, and Chanel. Crime Journal by Don Winslow. The Chapo Trap. Sold as a major drug war victory, the El Chapo trial was really just business as usual. Don Winslow is the best-selling author of The Cartel, The Power of the Dog, and The Border. Illustrations by R. Kikuo Johnson. Opening illustration, Guzman was one piece in a complex machinery involving both drug traffickers and police. It was the trial of the century, right? The satisfying third act in the dramatic rise and fall story of a celebrated mob boss who became one of the world's richest men, a Robin Hood who gave to the poor, a modern-day Houdini who escaped from not one but two maximum security prisons. And it was great show business with a full cast of characters, a compelling anti-hero, high-level drug traffickers who flipped, a sexy mistress, a beautiful young wife in the gallery. It had titillating stories of luxury jets, private zoos, a naked escape with said mistress through an elaborate tunnel, and wretched excesses of wealth that would bring a blush to the faces of the most shameless stars of reality TV. There was even a hint of celebrity, as the actor who portrays the defendant in the Netflix drama Narcos, Mexico, made the pilgrimage to see his real-life inspiration. Yes, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Loera, the infamous jefe of the all-powerful Sinaloa cartel, the godfather of the drug world, as one DEA official styled him, was brought to justice in a trial meant to stand as a major victory in the war on drugs. No fewer than 56 prosecution witnesses gave detailed, sometimes tedious, often gruesome testimony about beatings, tortures, and murders. There was even a suggestion that the jurors might be vulnerable to PTSD, which seemed a tad overwrought. The defense case was mercifully brief. One witness, Guzman, on the advice of his lawyers, chose not to testify in his own defense. It was good advice. The prosecutors would have ripped him to shreds on cross-examination, and he would hardly have made a sympathetic witness. But disappointing in that it deprived us of one crucial dramatic beat in any celebrity trial. In an ideal show business world, Guzman would have taken the stand and delivered a money line. You want answers? You can't handle the truth. More on that below. The jurors took their time, 6 days, deliberating, causing some anxiety for the prosecutors, and even some breathless media speculation that he might get off. All attorneys know that any time you send a case to a jury, you are rolling the dice. Despite your best attempts in voir dire, you never know what baggage an individual juror might bring in with him or her. A grudge against the legal system, sympathy for a charismatic rebel, a tent pitched firmly on a grassy knoll, a hang-'em-high mentality successfully concealed until it emerges full-blown in the jury room. Anything can happen. And the jurors faced a difficult task: to weigh guilt or innocence on 10 complicated charges, including conspiracy to traffic drugs, conspiracy to commit murder, and complicity in running an international criminal organization. Conviction on any one of the counts would send the defendant to prison for the rest of his life. The jury found Guzman guilty on all counts. It was the right call. The evidence was overwhelming. The U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York called the verdict a victory for law enforcement, for Mexico, and for the families who had lost loved ones to drug addiction. All that is true. And yet, in the big picture, none of it mattered. The Guzman trial will do nothing to stem the flow of narcotics into the United States. Don't get me wrong. Convicting Guzman for trafficking literally tons of drugs into the U.S. was a good thing. He's not Robin Hood. He's a killer responsible for untold suffering, surely far more than he's charged with. And if he spends the rest of his life in prison, it will be something like justice. But his capture and prosecution do nothing to ameliorate the American drug problem, and his conviction is likewise meaningless. The reason is simple. By the time of Guzman's capture, escape, and recapture in the farce that made him a celebrity, he had already lost most of his power. He was superfluous, expendable. The critical thing to understand is that Guzman wasn't, and never would be, the sole boss of the Sinaloa cartel. We tend to think of cartels as pyramids with a single head at the top, but in fact they are more like wedding cakes with several tiers. Guzman was on the top tier with others, the most important being Juan Esparragosa Moreno, widely rumored to be deceased, the late Ignacio Coronel Villarreal, and a man named Ismael El Mayo Zambada, who has been prominently featured, albeit in absentia, in this trial. A time-tested defense attorney, Maxim, says that if your client is obviously guilty, put someone else on trial. In their opening statement, Guzman's lawyers argued that he wasn't the real boss of the Sinaloa cartel, long the biggest drug trafficking organization in the world. Instead, they claimed that honor belonged to Zambada, and he has paid hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes to high-ranking officials in the Mexican government in order to remain, well, in absentia. Witnesses, including Zambada's own brother and son, testified to the same. But nobody calls Mayo Zambada the godfather of the drug world, and that's the way he likes it. You don't see Zambada interviewed in Rolling Stone, trying to launch romances with television stars, or working on a biopic about himself, as Guzman did. Zambada is a conservative businessman who prefers to stay behind the curtain. If there's a Don Corleone of Mexican drug lords, it is Ismael Zambada. And his partner, Guzman, was becoming increasingly problematic. Mob bosses remain in power as long as they're making other people money. Guzman had begun to cost people money. At the start of his downfall, he was suffering huge declines in marijuana profits due to legalization in America. Everyone was, and one of the cartel's responses was to get back into the heroin market for the first time since the 1970s, in order to grab a cut of the American pharmaceutical company's booming opioid addict market. The cartels produced so much heroin that they created a surplus, which, in a reversal of previous policy, they started to sell inside Mexico. Guzman got greedy and demanded a cut of the profits from local dealers in Sinaloa, thereby alienating his own power base. Combine that with his increasingly bizarre antics, more about that later, and it's clear why he had become a liability to his partners, principally Zambada. Sources in Mexico inform me that Zambada, aging and ailing, has been wanting to take his billions and retire quietly. But he had another problem besides Guzman. Two sons who were facing long sentences in the United States. In 2010, Zambada's son Vicente was extradited to the U.S. for drug trafficking and was looking at a potential life sentence. In November 2013, his brother Serafin was arrested in Arizona for a conspiracy to traffic cocaine and methamphetamine and faced a sentence of 10 years to life, as well as a $10 million fine. In 2014, it came to light that Vicente had cut a secret plea deal, agreeing to testify against Guzman. In February 2015, Serafin was transferred to an undisclosed location, but there was no record of him in federal custody. It was widely assumed at the time that he, like his brother, needed someone to trade up for, and that it wasn't going to be his father. The increasingly erratic, increasingly public Guzman was the obvious candidate. It is no coincidence that Guzman was initially captured while the Zambada brothers were making their deals. In March 2018, Serafin was sentenced to 5.5 years. He was released last September. Still, Guzman retained enough support, influence, and money to engineer his 2015 daring escape, allegedly accomplished through a near mile-long tunnel dug under the maximum security prison walls and also under the supposedly unwitting noses of the Mexican army, the federales, and the prison authorities. It was neither daring nor an escape, but rather a bought and paid for departure. Prison surveillance video shows a fully dressed Guzman getting into the shower behind the privacy wall, enough said, in his cell, which blocks the view as he supposedly goes down the tunnel entrance. Despite the testimony of Guzman's former right-hand man, Damasco Lopez, there is still cause to doubt that he ever went into that tunnel. If you can afford $15 million in construction cost and bribes to build a tunnel, you can also afford not to have to use it. It's possible he went out the front door, the same as he did during his first escape in 2001, for which there was also a face-saving official explanation that he went out hidden in a laundry cart. Guzman might actually have remained free if this spectacle hadn't brought so much attention and embarrassment to the Mexican government. The media frenzy brought pressure, especially from the U.S., that forced Mexico to launch an intense manhunt, as well as raids, arrest, and seizures of product targeting the whole Sinaloa organization. In other words, Guzman's shenanigans cost the cartel money. The old truism that there's no such thing as bad publicity is definitely not true for organized crime figures, and for whatever reason, whether he became enamored of his own press clippings or just came to believe his own legend, Guzman started to seek the limelight. He wanted Hollywood to make a biopic about him, and that effort, combined with his infatuation with Mexican soap opera star Kate del Castillo, led Guzman to sit for an infamous interview with the actor Sean Penn for Rolling Stone magazine. The article, which disclosed that Penn and Del Castillo passed through a nearby army checkpoint on their way to the meeting, has been credited with leading Mexican law enforcement to Guzman's location. Let's be real. They already knew where he was. But the publicity helped persuade Zambada and other decision-makers that it was time not just to allow Guzman to be removed, but to demand it. The only condition was that he not be hurt. Five of his associates were killed in the raid that netted him, but Guzman and his assistant were unharmed. This much is sure. Guzman would not have been recaptured or extradited without the permission and cooperation of Zambada and other powerful figures in the cartel and Mexican government. Now Vicente is seeking the rare and coveted S-5 visa, which will allow him and his family to remain in the U.S. for 3 years, and indefinitely, if all goes according to plan. His testimony at the trial included a lot of incriminating evidence about Guzman, as well as about his own father, whom he named as the head of the Sinaloa cartel. The testimony that Vicente did give has been viewed as a betrayal of the cartel and his father. But was it really? Or did the father give his son permission to save himself by telling what everyone already knows anyway, a common practice among narcos facing long sentences in the U.S.? Unlike the mafia, the Mexican cartels encourage their members who have been arrested to tell everything they know if they can cut a deal for a shorter sentence. All they are obliged to do is relay what they've given up to defense attorneys, who then pass the information on so the cartels can make the necessary adjustments. And the most damaging testimony Vicente has given has been against Guzman. In a sense, one can view the Zambada's testimony as an extension of the internal conflict now being fought between the Zambada faction of the Sinaloa cartel and the Guzman faction led by three of Chapo's adult sons. The fix was in, and that's why this trial made no difference to the overall drug problem. The export of cocaine, methamphetamine, and especially heroin didn't even slow after Guzman's arrest. To be sure, the cartel has been in chaos since Guzman's extradition, but it is partly due to internal bickering, because the power-sharing arrangement that Guzman had envisioned among his sons, Zambada and Damasco Lopez, has fallen apart. The larger issue is the rise of a new powerhouse, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, which is successfully contesting the Sinaloans for smuggling routes, border crossing, and poppy fields. Other smaller organizations have also rushed to fill the power gap. Perhaps as a result, in the wake of Chapo's extradition, Mexico has suffered its two most murderous years since its government started to keep track in 1997. If you think that Guzman's incarceration has been a major victory in the war on drugs, explain why heroin overdoses in the United States have risen dramatically, not fallen, since his capture. The drug problem has gotten worse, not better. It's business as usual, because it's set up to be. Guzman was one piece, albeit an important one, in a complex machinery composed of drug traffickers and police on both sides of the border, as well as military, judicial, political, governmental, and business entities. Together, they make the international drug trade possible. The scope of this enterprise is gargantuan. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars a year that flow from the United States to Mexico. Money that has been reinvested in legitimate business in Mexico, the United States, and around the world. Some of it finds its way into the pockets of top government officials, including one or more presidents, if Guzman's lawyers and some witnesses are to be believed. Next illustration, by the time of Guzman's escape and recapture, he'd already lost much of his power. Mayo Zambada's brother, Jesus, now in prison in the United States, testified that the partners in the cartel pooled more than $50 million to bribe the government of then-President Felipe Calderon. This accusation is strenuously denied. He has further stated, although Judge Brian Cogan suppressed this testimony, that he paid several million dollars in bribes to a representative of current president and then Mexico City Mayor Andres Manuel López Obrador. López Obrador has declined to comment on this allegation. Alex Cifuentes, a former high-ranking Guzman aide, testified that the cartel sent $100 million to then-Mexican President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto, 2012 to 2018, to protect Guzman from capture, and that he told American authorities about the alleged bribe back in 2016. Spokesmen for Peña Nieto have indignantly denied Cifuentes' claim. We might well suspect the veracity of drug traffickers. They are certainly not angels, and mendacity would be the most venial of their sins. But there are good reasons to believe them. They are all in American federal custody and have negotiated lenient sentencing deals that would be voided if they were found to have committed perjury. As such, they've already pleaded guilty to drug charges and therefore have nothing to hide. Furthermore, they haven't contradicted one another, and audio surveillance tapes entered into evidence have confirmed important parts of their testimony. Most importantly, the revelations that these witnesses brought forward aren't revelatory. They merely confirm what we've always known. I've been writing about the Mexican drug world for 2 decades, and I've heard credible accounts of these bribes and payoffs continually from day one. I'm not unique in this regard. One highly respected journalist after another has reported these stories, some at the cost of their lives. The point is that systemic corruption has been in place for many years. It remains in place, and it is far larger and far more powerful than a single defendant, even the supposed godfather of the drug world. The real godfathers of the drug world sit in comfortable offices, not in a trial dock or a cell. Sure, putting away a bad guy like Guzman is a good thing, but he's only the latest in a long list. Pedro Aviles, Miguel Ángel Félix Gallardo, Amado Carrillo Fuentes, the Lord of the Skies, Pablo Escobar, Nicky Barnes, Benjamin Arellano Félix, Osiel Cárdenas, and now Chapo Guzman. To what end? Drugs are more plentiful, more potent, and less expensive than ever. We'll never find an answer to the drug problem until we ask the big questions about systemic corruption, the nexus between drug trafficking, government, and business, the prison industrial complex that is funded by drug convictions, and the very nature of drug use and addiction itself. What is the true nature of the drug trafficking machine? What is the depth and width of the corruption that allows it to flourish? Where do the billions of dollars go? How does it provide protection? And who provides that protection? And something else. And maybe this is the truth that we can't handle. Corruption is not the sole property of traffickers and their enablers. We own it, too. We have to ask the question, what is the corruption of the American soul that makes us want the drugs in the first place? Opioids, which are killing more Americans now than either car crashes or guns, are a response to pain. We have to ask the question, what is the pain? Until we ask and answer that question, the drug problem will always be with us. And the trial of the century? Sorry, but it just doesn't matter. Now here's the March 2019 cover story, Miley Everlasting. A flash marriage, a new home, after a heartbreaking loss, the pop provocateur is still figuring out who she is in real time, and that's how she wants it, by Zach Barron. Photographs by Ryan McGinley, styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Miley Cyrus, photographed in Miami. Before we begin, Miley Cyrus would like to read something she's written. She's not sure what to call it, actually. At one point, she says op-ed, but it's not an op-ed. Statement? It's kind of a statement. She's trying to explain herself. In November, her home in Malibu, the one she shared with her partner, Liam Hemsworth, along with two pigs, two horses, four cats, and seven dogs, burned to the ground. About a month and a half later, right around Christmas, she and Hemsworth got married. She's still trying to make sense of it all, how one thing led to the other. Cyrus recently turned 26. The debut episode of Hannah Montana, the Disney show that made her famous, aired when she was 13, which means she's now been a public figure, a teen idol, then pop star, then pariah, and on to whatever she is now for more than half of her life. She's had three number one albums, more than 82 million followers on Instagram, a number that grows by disconcerting amounts every day. On the day she announced her wedding, almost 400,000 new followers. This is far from the first time she's had to do something like this, to work out who she is in front of an audience. In fact, it's all she knows, really. I remember getting my license and it being a big deal that I was driving, she says, almost like the milestones in my life were milestones for America. It almost felt like America was a weird godparent, you know? Or maybe, now that she thinks about it, it was the other way around. I was so influential in kids' lives that I was like America's nanny, Cyrus says, laughing. Like, just sit your kids in front of me and I'll teach them how to be a good person. Which maybe backfired on the American godparent. In the time between Hannah Montana and now, Cyrus has experienced nearly every kind of attention this world is capable of giving. The weight of a million eyeballs on you, who will never have to deal with the criticism or the magnifying glass that we deal with ever in their lives. As her friend and fellow former child star Ariana Grande puts it, Cyrus has also become adept at disappearing when necessary. Last year, her plan was simple. Hide out in Malibu, work on a new record, live life with her dogs and her pigs and her survival partner, which is what she called Hemsworth, before what she calls him now, which is husband. But then came the fire, which banished her from Malibu, and the wedding, which brought her back, sharply, into the public eye. And suddenly it was 2019, and Cyrus found herself with a story she didn't yet know how to tell. Where I am in life right now is very complex, even to myself, Cyrus says. So I wrote something that, in my mind, could maybe come before our conversation. One night, not long ago, she was in bed. It was 3:30 in the morning, and I couldn't sleep, she says. And suddenly the words started to come. She typed them out on her phone. From where I'm sitting, I can see the text, scrolling down far beyond the lower edge of the screen. She asked if I wouldn't mind if she read it out loud, right now. Her mind goes fast, usually, really fast. The wilder I am, the faster pace I'm going, Cyrus says. But she's going to try to slow down. She's going to try to get through it. Sometimes I feel like you don't even know how you feel, until you just let yourself go, she says. So, here we go. I try to be true to myself in every state of being. When I can, I will stand still, work through, sit in, observe, and get to know who that is, exactly, privately. My creative process comes from feeling inspired by life experiences, not pressured by industry standards. I will never put my own plan before nature's or jeopardize personal growth for professional advantage. That said, if it's a time in my life like now where I am publicly sharing my stories, my music, my art, who I am unfolds in front of everyone, and we go through all of this together. When people hear my music, they hear a fragment of time, something I feel or felt right then. By the time it gets to your ears, I may have grown past it, but I am truest to who I am at that very second. That can be 5,000 different colors and shades at the same time. I'm a creative vessel that thrives on change and evolution. I love to feel and to feel extremes. Of course, there's a little bit of a never-satisfied artist that lives inside me that becomes bored easily, so I move through life quickly. But I have a home base and center I can come back to, a calm and a peace. I can't be in it for too long, but it's a place to catch my breath. That's the foundation I have had since the beginning. For the time being, Cyrus's home is Nashville, where she has a house not far from the one she grew up in. But this week she's coming to Miami because she missed the sun, which she hasn't seen in weeks, and because she had a photo shoot, and because she's always wanted to visit Gianni Versace's old mansion, which is still here on Ocean Drive and is now a hotel overseen by a lively Italian man in a black suit named Armando. Today, Armando has seated us in a private dining room to talk. When our minders are gone, Cyrus removes a tiny vape pen from her Versace clutch and inhales a few times. She is dressed for the occasion so thoroughly, vintage Versace caftan, vintage Versace slides, vintage Versace earrings, vintage Versace watch, vintage Versace ring with a Medusa the size of a half dollar on it, that she blends into different parts of the hotel. A superhero who hasn't quite figured out how to control her powers. When she steps in front of the hotel's bright swimming pool, the one based on a Versace scarf, and which took 50 skilled artisans a full year to complete, she nearly disappears, a shimmer of color against a shimmer of color. She speaks like someone who is as interested in figuring out what Miley Cyrus thinks as the rest of us are. "I surprise my own self with my choices," she says. "Sometimes I'll even think, why the F did I do that? Or, what got me there? What? Why?" She's very sincere and equally nonlinear. The producer Mark Ronson told me that she once attempted to describe to him the system she uses to keep track of her clothing. "They're filed by, like, mood, color, and designer," he says. "It's like somebody told you they had a record collection, but they stored it by the last initial of the recording engineer's first name. I was getting a migraine while she was describing it." In the studio, he says, she's the same way. How quickly her mind turns. "If my brain worked that fast, or could take in that much stuff and process it at the same time, I'd be constantly on the verge of an anxiety attack, I think, because it's a lot." Wayne Coyne, the Flaming Lips frontman and a frequent Cyrus collaborator, tells a story about a car ride they once took. "She would get stoned and have answers to every riddle there's ever been," he says. "There was a building that was a jail in Nashville that she and Liam were going to buy and transform into a homeless shelter and a venue. And this was all in one conversation. She was going to buy an airline that people could put their pets on so you could fly with your pets, and her line was going to be for pets only. She just gets excited, and all these things are possibilities." Conversation with Cyrus is a little like trying to tune a radio between stations, with different bits of song coming through. "I'd be really happy to just explain kind of where I'm at, obviously in my relationship, how the music can even kind of be very contradictory," she says in a rush. "But, like, you know my truth, I also wrote a lot of this next record before my effing entire house burned down and my whole effing life changed. It was Hemsworth who bought that house years ago, but Cyrus, it turned out, had been there first. "You couldn't make this up," she says. "The first record that I ever made as myself, not as Hannah Montana, the first record I ever made as Miley Cyrus, I did most of that record in that house. A producer named Matthew Wilder used to live there, and Cyrus worked with him in a studio on the property. Years later, after she and Hemsworth had started dating on the set of a 2010 Nicholas Sparks movie called The Last Song, and then split up, temporarily as it would turn out, Hemsworth purchased the house from Wilder without knowing its history. And then he shows up, ready to move in, and the old owners are cleaning out the garage and getting out all these plaques and shit with my face on it. Liam showed up and was like, 'What the F?' In time, he and Cyrus got back together, and she moved into the house with him. They had art, as well as most of Cyrus's music, from 2013's Bangers on, stored around the property, laptops, hard drives, scraps of paper with handwritten lyrics on them. When the Woolsey fire arrived, Cyrus was in South Africa, shooting an episode of Black Mirror. Hemsworth evacuated their animals, and then, like more than 1,000 other homes in the area, it was gone, along with everything in it. 'The night it happened,' she says, 'I got the journal that was next to me and just started writing out what I was feeling. Some of the feelings did not add up with the others. Some of them were super angry. Some of them were relieved in a way, which feels really effing weird. It was like there were some weights tied to my ankles, and I was in the ocean, and someone just cut those ties, and I was able to float and be free, because I didn't have all this shit attached to me. Anger, relief, sadness, a feeling of, I'm never going to get over it, this is never going to end. But we heal up, and our brains get used to imagining a worst-case scenario happening over and over again. They want to rebuild, but at the moment, she's trying to allow herself to experience life without a center. I'll never be happy that all those memories and pictures and things that I've loved are gone,' Cyrus says. 'But to have an experience like this, I find myself feeling more connected to being human again. Getting married grew out of what she and Hemsworth went through,' she says. 'When you experience what we experienced together with someone, it is like glue. You're the only two people in the world who can understand. Losing my home, losing that peace, was very unsettling. I didn't go back. I felt like my roots got ripped from under me. I was working on Black Mirror in South Africa. The day I heard we lost our home, my scene was set at my house in Malibu. My character was having a panic attack, so needless to say, the inspiration was there. Anne Sawitsky, the director, and I became very close, since going through all of this so far from home, she was really the only mother figure I had. Experiencing that together and in the realness of it all, we created something I think is magical. It's hard for me to be proud of my work. I rarely walk away satisfied, but I'm very proud of what we made. It really tells my story in some dark and funny way, as that show does and as life is. To lose everything, at that time, materially, because no lives of people I know and love were lost, Liam and I also found a new bond underneath all that rubble. Going through a natural disaster, the grief you experience is really unlike any other loss. No more, just different. In our position, it feels or looks like everything is replaceable, and you can start again, but you can't buy spirit. Our place wasn't filled with expensive, meaningless shit, but art, a lot of which I made on my own and by others, including personal letters and drawings from Heath Ledger, John Cracfolusi, Joan Jett, Murakami, David LaChapelle, Ryan McGinley, and so many others whom I respect. Do you feel different being married? 0% different. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.